This is WGTDHD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Guida Brown, former executive director of the Hope Council, Dr. Steve Brown, retired professor of educational leadership and school law, Dr. Karen Sconsert, chair of the education department and associate professor at Carthage College, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, professor of communications at UW Parkside, and Stephanie Skilba, Vice President for Community and Government Relations at Gateway Technical College. And now, here's today's moderator for Education Matters.
Hello, this is Jonathan Shaler, Professor of Communication at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. I'm your host for today's program, Education Matters, and I'm very delighted and honored to have as my guest today Dr. Mark Gopin. Mark Gopin is the James H. Lowe Professor of Religion, Diplomacy, and Conflict Resolution, and Director of the Center on Religion, Diplomacy, and Conflict Resolution at George Mason University's School for Conflict Analysis and Resolution. I first became aware of his work when I was developing a course on conflict and world religion some years ago, and his work was central to that study. Mark has lectured on conflict resolution in Switzerland, Ireland, India, Italy, as well as at Harvard, Yale, Columbia, Princeton, and numerous other academic institutions. He's trained thousands of people worldwide in peacemaking strategies for complex conflicts in which religion and culture play a role. He's led interventions for conflict resolution and diplomacy training for over 30 years in the Middle East, particularly in Israel and Palestine and Syria, but also in Afghanistan and Iran. Since 2012, Gopin has pioneered interventions in Turkey and Jordan with Syrian survivors and activists. He's engaged in back-channel diplomacy with religious, political, and military figures on both sides of conflicts, especially in the Arab-Israeli conflict. He's appeared on numerous media outlets, including CNN, CNN International, Court TV, the Jim Lehrer NewsHour, Israel Radio, National Public Radio, The Connection, Voice of America, and the National Public Radios of Sweden, Ireland, and Northern Ireland. He's been published in the International Herald Tribune, the Boston Globe, the Christian Science Monitor, and his work has been featured in news stories of the Times of London, the Times of India, Associated Press, and Newhouse News Service, regarding issues of conflict resolution, religion, and violence. Mark's research is found in numerous book chapters and journal articles, and he is the author of many books, including Between Eden and Armageddon, The Future of World Religions, Violence, and Peacemaking, Holy War, Holy Peace, How Religion Can Bring Peace to the Middle East. That's a study on what was missing from the Oslo process and what will be necessary culturally for a successful Arab-Israeli peace process. Also, Healing the Heart of Conflict and To Make the Earth Whole, The Art of Citizen Diplomacy in an Age of Religious Militancy, and Bridges Across an Impossible Divide, The Inner Lives of Arab and Jewish Peacemakers, and most recently, Compassionate Reasoning, Changing the Mind to Change the World. Of that book, Ted Kapchuk, professor of global health and social medicine at Harvard Medical School, says that Rabbi Dr. Mark Gopin is a profound, compassionate, and bold leader. He has selflessly worked in tumultuous locations on the planet, torn apart by conflicts across cultural, religious, gender, and ethnic divisions. As a proponent for nonviolent, peaceful resolutions of global conflict, his real-world experiences are infused with reflections on ethics, moral philosophy, religious wisdom, and new developments in the neuroscience of compassion. This is a must-read for anyone concerned about our troubling times. I hope I pronounced his name correctly and all the other names, yeah. Mark. Oh, good.
Perfect.
Great. Well, that was a longish introduction, but I think it was important to get all that out there so that people know who I'm speaking with. It's really a delight to have you here. And as I mentioned to you in preparing for this program, I'm really most interested in talking about recent developments in the Israel-Palestine conflict, obviously, beginning most recently on October 7th with the Hamas attacks. And I had a series of questions for you. Hopefully we can reflect together on the conflict itself, your perspective on the conflict, and what, how you go about teaching, and what you might recommend for teachers who are trying to find their feet with presenting this to their students.
Yeah. Well, sure. Well, the one, just to back up for a minute on the whole field of conflict analysis and resolution, I actually, it's a new field in human history. It started in the 1980s, and, you know, 40 years is very short for an academic subject. It's very much a multidisciplinary concoction of people from political science, sociology, anthropology, psychology, and also history. My particular contribution was putting in religion, world religions, or the diversity of religions, which is like a subset of the diversity of cultures in the world. And the reason why the field went in that direction of starting off basically proto-psychological with human needs theory and others, and moved into cultural diversity and then religion diversity, is that there's no understanding any conflict in the world, that there's no way to treat conflicts without an attention to two things that are polar opposites. One is what we can see generally, and how they behave, and what makes them either more violent or less violent, what makes them more cooperative or less cooperative, healthier or sicker. And then there's the very particular expressions of people through their cultures and through their religions and through their languages. And though that's been missing from a lot of political science, international relations, they've tended to look at things in a very generalized ways that end up not being good for, not being good for real healing. My emphasis of my approach is very much on conflict healing. One of my first books is called Healing the Heart of Conflict. And so from the healing of the heart of conflict all the way to the neuroscience and compassion, my emphasis and others like the great Dalai Lama and others has been, or Tom Merton, has been on the human heart and the transformation of the heart through encounters with others. So what that leads to in terms of educational materials is that you certainly need good historical background from general histories. And so Alan Doughty, D-O-W-T-Y, has a good history of the Israel-Palestine conflict and of Zionism. There's Arthur Hertzberg's The Idea of Zionism. But what's missing is a more detailed understanding of the people and how their relationships were in the last couple of hundred years that led to this point. And there you need to go sometimes to journalists, sometimes to great novelists. You know, you want to study the novels of two peoples. Tom Segev, specifically, S-E-G-E-V, is a wonderful source. He wrote a book called One Palestine Complete that was a detailed life and biography of various people in the 20s, which was when Zionism was really getting started, but there was also a Palestinian population, and there was just a large mixing between Jews and Arabs, Muslims, Jews, and Christians in the Holy Land. And so start to see all the relationships that existed and the intertwining relations, and also the reasons why, as nationalism takes over the 20th century, why these people end up in two such polar opposite camps and how that evolved. You can't really help them to heal unless you know the evolution of what was. And these surprising facts, the fact that, you know, for hundreds of years in the city of Tiberias, the ultra-Orthodox Jews and the ultra-Orthodox Muslims lived literally in a synagogue and a Muslim and a mosque together, you know, side by side, and had relations for 300 years. And you start to see, well, religion isn't necessarily the problem. You know, And maybe it's even a solution sometimes. So you start to get into the nuances of what went wrong and what went right in history and the inner lives of these people. And then you start to be a little bit more adept at thinking about possible solutions.
Yeah. Getting close to the humanity of the people involved. It reminds me of a book I came across. Have you heard of one called Blood Brothers? It's a first-person account of a man who knew people on both sides of the conflict. And
perfect.
Yeah, yeah. So,
and the more you give your students that variety,
yeah,
the more that you push their thinking into the neocortex. You want people to have the best pro-social emotions, but you don't want their horror of war or their anger or their need to decide who's righteous and who's evil. You don't want that to overtake the brain. Mm-hmm. And the best way to prevent that from overtaking the brain is information about people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The more they have that, the less that their brain goes to that space of declaring good and evil, which are very flat when you think about them. Both the good and the evil are flat thinking, mm-hmm. and they come from the brainstem, which needs simplicity. And so that's why students and teachers do very well when they keep people on complexity and understanding, being able to empathize with story.
Yes.
But not all story on one side, because then you just make
right. Sometimes a third story, one that's not the perspective of either group or even of that time, can be a way of broadening one's horizon as one looks at the conflict. I think of Shakespeare's play Titus Andronicus, which is his supreme revenge tragedy, and it comes to mind when I think of the horrors of some of the attention to detail that was paid by Hamas on October 7th in making this as horrific as possible an experience for Israelis. That was in Titus Andronicus. There's something going on there where you want to not only injure your opponent physically, but you want to traumatize them in the deepest way possible. Can you speak to that for a moment? It's a hard one, but...
No, it's not. It's not self-evident. Yeah. Thank you for raising Shakespeare. Shakespeare is brilliant. I know that your wonderful project on Shakespeare in prison is fantastic.
Thank you.
People assume that people have committed crimes are not capable of this kind of complexity, and that's just wrong. And in fact, the work that we do in the field is often with warriors. And warriors are just people where there's no law and order versus criminals. It's not that as different. And one of the aspects of warriorship is not just murder and not just hitting people where they're the most wounded, but humiliation is important. And then the other thing that's important is re-traumatization. So all the things that psychology and mental health try to heal are exactly what warriorship tries to actually create. Mm. So one of those is knowing where your enemy is the weakest,
mm-hmm.
taking that from them. So in the Jewish case, that's the Holocaust and 1,000 years of persecution in the most humiliating ways, particularly to the body of the Jew, to injure the body, to humiliate, to rape the women, to mutilate. These are all Holocaust type things, to burn people alive. They made sure to burn people alive on that day, whole families. They killed families in front of each other. They killed the children in front of the parents. All of these things are known in Jewish history and are exactly why Israel was created by the Zionists, who felt this was the only way to be protected. Conversely, as this has gone on and gotten worse, and I know the Jewish community quite intimately because I grew up with this and I'm rabbi and all of that, is that tragically, Israeli military has had a tendency to do the most possible injury to Palestinian pride, which is in their olive trees and in their houses, and to destroy the very thing that is the point of pride. And if you worked in the Middle East for 30, 40 years, as I have, even in refugee camps, the men will go out of their way to welcome you into their tent with great pride at what they created in their home. Mm. But when you destroy homes, when you flatten them, not to mention when you flatten them with the families inside, you're doing the worst possible humiliation and destruction. And our jobs as outsiders is to try and pull people back from this these moments where the most angry people on both sides become in charge of the battlefield and sweep everybody else along with them. Because after all, you don't need, you know, there's 2 million people in Gaza. They needed 3,000 people who were willing to go in that day and do a Holocaust, okay? They didn't need 1 million people to agree with them. They didn't need 2 million people. They just needed 3,000 young men. And that's how wars happen. They happen because people get a hold of small units and do horrible things. And then the rest of us get swept up in the rage and the fear and the re-traumatization, including bystanders. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to pick a side because this is so horrible. Somebody's got to be blaming here to blame. And therefore, you know, so there are ways that teachers and educators can carefully recreate this without trauma. They have to be very careful to not use the educational format. It's easy to do. And you don't want to, ethically, I don't agree with that. But there are ways to help students understand what it would be in terms of bullying, because bullying is essentially a lot of this. Mm-hmm. How do you pull back from bullying? What do you do with the one person in the class that seems to enjoy hurting people? How do you deal with that? You know, do you join sides and so on and so forth?
Mm. Yeah. Back to where you mentioned the importance of land for both sides. I know I came across recently, and I think it was the newish documentary on the settlers of Israeli settlers, very richly woven narrative about the situation there on the West Bank. I don't know what you think of it. Did you see it?
I've worked with a lot of people.
Yeah, you know.
I can't say for sure that I know everything that was in that particular text, but
There was just one story that struck me when you were talking about the importance of land and hitting people where it hurts. There was an Israeli settler who a mother with her child, and she was talking to the interviewer, and the interviewer asked, "Why are you in a yurt? Why are you living in a yurt?" And she said, "So that I can if they come after us, I can take this down. They're not going to take it down. I take it down." And I just thought that was an interesting way of defending against the insult of having someone remove your home.
But what people, you know, and then what people don't know, because how complex this is that there's whole community of Jews called, there's something called Tag Meir. There's an expression for revenge among the most radical settlers called price tag, to make Palestinians pay a price when there's a suicide bombing. This goes back 20, 30 years now. Mm. And there was a Jewish group that made a tag, an opposite tag. And that is the tag of going after people who've been injured by settlers. Mm-hmm. So you literally have Palestinian families all over the West Bank. They get assaulted by radical settlers. And then there's another Jewish group that comes in solidarity with them and helps them to harvest their olives, to try and heal the trees that were uprooted. I mean, it's very, very messy here. Mm-hmm. And that's why outsiders have to ask yourself, it's just like any bullying situation. What do you do when there's the bully, there's two tribes, and do you make it worse or do you try to make it better? How do you find the good people? How do they have courage without making it all worse? You know, what can they do? And there's so many people who are courageous and their hearts are filled with innovative approaches to the other side to try and stop the damage. Ultimately, there's no solutions without political and military and police, because there's a lot of power going on here. You can't end this without ending the funding for terrorism. You can't end this without without neutralizing those who want to fund terrorist groups in the world. And you have to go after that. And the Israeli public has to make a totally different decision about the use of force. So the Americans and others have to help them make that decision forcefully. So there's a lot of ways that you can help in this situation, but you really have to understand it first.
Yes. So, thinking of the applications to teaching then, I'm hearing in what you're saying a few things. One obviously is that there's more than one narrative, and to understand, as you say in your materials, the dual narratives of the region, at least dual narrative. And then there's just the universality of some conflict dimensions like that of bullying, and seeing, looking at these dynamics and understanding their relationship to conflict more generally, conflict in our own lives, making a connection that way. And then in terms of the complexity of the conflict and the international dynamics, if we could dwell there for a moment, I recall way back the Media Education Foundation under Sut Jolly's leadership came up with this, for me, a really transformative documentary. I think it was titled Peace, Propaganda and the Promised Land. And it was a review of U.S. media coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict throughout history, as far back as they could go, with a focus on more recent times. This documentary is now pretty old. It's, I think it came out in 2004, but it was the nature of, a critical approach to what the information that we're getting from our own media, and the media landscape has certainly changed radically since then. Still, the documentary seems to have some currency for me in that it encourages a critical perspective, and it also points out the power dynamics of how the United States is implicated in this conflict. How do you approach that when you look at the United States' role in the conflict?
Well, there's two things you've raised. One is about the media and the other one is about the United States, and I'll treat them separately.
Okay.
The media issue is something that all conflicts in the world today are being driven by the explosion of manipulation by media that is a part and parcel of the modern communication systems. It was always the case that rumor mongering, one of the reasons why the Bible has so many rules against rumors and against tale-bearing and slander, which all sounds very quaint now, is that that's what our media is. When you think about it, a lot of our media is slandering and rumor-mongering and tale-bearing. The fact that there's evidence-based in various places makes it look like something called journalism, and there is some great journalism, but what we've discovered is that it's all partial information. You can have a very good evidence-based description of all the most horrible things that Palestinian terrorists have ever done to Jewish people, and you will only have a fraction of the story. The evidence-based, you could even show all the incitement to violence all over the Middle East, the hatred coming from Islamic preachers and so on. You could prove it all. It's all there. But if that's all you do, and you don't know anything about what happened between 1880 and 1948 in terms of what happened to Palestinians in 48, then you don't know anything.
Right.
So if you add that to the whole tragedy in America between right and left, if you add that to the tragedy between Ukraine and Russia and so on, the Uyghurs and the Chinese and so on, you start to realize that our world is a world of manipulation. So we really, the only solution we have for that so far is not just dual narrative. It's many, many narratives. It's understanding, is not assuming you know anything unless you have talked to women as well as men, as talked to old people as well as teenagers, talked to highly educated people as well as very, very uneducated people, and on, and a very, very secular anti-religious people and very, very religious people, and very religious people who are violent and very religious people who are pacifists, because they are all there in these conflicts. They're all there.
Yeah.
And the more that you get those narratives, the more you start to see, how did this situation go wrong and how could it go right? As far as the United States policy.
I just need to pause because this is a good moment for me to do station identification.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
This is Education Matters on WGTD Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan Shaler. We are speaking with Dr. Mark Gobin, Professor of Conflict Analysis and Resolution at George Mason University. We're talking about the Israel-Palestine conflict, and the question that we're on right now has to do with United States involvement.
Yeah, so as far as United States involvement, that generally, in my experience, is a loaded position. It's already a very partisan position, and the reason is that it's assuming that the United States is all-powerful, and that they are determining what's happening, and it couldn't be further from the truth. The fact is that in most conflicts, even in states that are highly totalitarian, you know, if you're talking about Chinese support for North Korea, to assume that everything is decided in Beijing is a gross oversimplification of understanding the North Korean ruling family and the Communist Party and so on. So the same thing here is that the United States, basically the United States makes a great deal of money by selling weapon systems in different parts of the world. And most of that is to create American jobs. A lot of the impetus for major weapon systems is actually jobs. That's how it works. And it's the same thing with big contracts of all kinds for construction in different parts of the world. So the United States is heavily invested in contracts with Israel, but they're at the same time, they're heavily invested in Egypt and in places that are technically Israel's enemies. Even the enemy system, people don't realize that Turkey is one of the most vocal opponents of Israel, and then you take away the cover, and most of the steel and gas actually they're in full economic partnership.
Wow.
Yeah. So all of this rhetoric on who's to blame and who's really pulling the strings. So if you're going to get into that game, the United States has some influence on Israeli policy. But my experience is that it's the push and pull of how elections went based on, you see, the American move towards highly manipulative politics based on polling and based on free media actually had a bigger influence on Israel than any policy. With the habit of being able to give out free papers to people. The right wing had their own free newspaper, and the left wing has these very expensive journals that are only read by intellectuals. Wow. So that became a problem. And you see the same thing in the United States with Fox versus, you know, NPR and so on and so forth, that people started to realize that moving people emotionally towards fear and loathing of the other is big business, and it works. And that started to influence things. And then every time there's a terrorist bomb, every time there's some event, and that is where the axis of Russia, Iran, Hezbollah, and others play an important role in support for Hamas. But it gets really complicated because the $1 billion that went to Hamas did not come from Iran. It came from Qatar. And Qatar is an American ally. And Qatar is an ally in the sense that we have our major base in Qatar. So when you look at the details of this, it becomes really inexplicable unless you start to understand that very, very few actors in this world are committed to a Palestinian democratic state. I had the same experience in Syria. The amount of countries that are interested in a Syrian democracy was zero among their neighbors. Everyone invested in either the regime, Assad regime, or in the jihadi extremists. So they were the ones that were funded to fight each other.
Oh.
But everyone killed the Democrats. And we have the same problem in Palestine, is that everyone defunds the Democrats, but invests in the war. And that's something that people need to understand at a deeper level if they want to stop this. They cannot let Iran and Russia off scot-free. They need to expose Qatar playing two ends against, you know, Qatar's an ally of the United States and Israel, and then they go ahead and fund Hamas. And then even worse than this, which will blow your mind, is that the right wing of Israel enabled those funds to go to Hamas.
Oh, yeah.
The right wing of Israel doesn't want a Palestinian state, doesn't want a liberal Palestinian democratic state. They want Hamas there to say, you see, the Palestinians can't be given a state. Mm. So it's a paradox. And we're going to continue to be manipulated right and left unless we get smarter about that and not think that the big father of the world is the United States. It doesn't work that way.
Nice. Thank you for that. But this is such a grim picture because based on what you just said, it sounds like the overwhelming majority of powers has a vested interest in preventing a Palestinian democracy because it would be in some way destabilizing to current arrangements. And so where is there room or leverage for change then?
I think there is. I think democracies do get born. I think that we need a more mature approach than being constantly manipulated by rightist and leftist thinking. That right-wing thinking and left-wing thinking are both misguided. They both are a distortion of reality. Mm. And it keeps us from getting to constructive collaborations. So in Israel, it's the same thing. In Palestine, it's the same thing. We have a lot of Israelis and Palestinians that work together for 20, 30 years now on building up democratic equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel, for example. There are 20% of Israel, this is again what the propaganda news doesn't tell you, 20% of Israel's population is Palestinian. Right. They have full citizenship. That citizenship was not completely equal in a Jewish-tending state, but it has gotten more equal in the last 20 years due to the equality of economic opportunity. That was something that was fought hard. There's millions of dollars going in from the United States, from progressive people, progressive Jews, to make that happen. And that is the model for what Palestine, Israel could be. And so there is progress in the middle of regress. And it was the same in Northern Ireland before the solution to Ireland. Northern Ireland looked like there was no solution, but slowly underneath the surface, there were webs of relationships between Catholics and Protestants who wanted a nonviolent society. And they won eventually with a great deal of investment and a great deal of money that went into that coexistence and equality. The same can happen here, but we can't do it if we're all divided by foolish generalizations and infantilized notions of good and evil. That's what's preventing us from moving forward. But yeah, you know, all sorts of monarchies and non-democratic governments, why do they want a democracy in the middle of the Middle East? What a single democracy from all the way from West Africa, from the west of the Middle East all the way to the Far East. Why mess it up with a democracy that would call into question all the autocratic governments?
So
this is not an easy fix
on
either side. But once you maturely understand the challenge, then you can build build alternatives together.
Yeah, quite a task, but I hear that. And I look at the map of Israel-Palestine, of course, and how it's changed over the years and where it is now. And it just seems, you know, if you're looking for clean boundaries or definitions, it looks like a mess. There already is so much interpenetration and interdependence in various ways that it seems like, to me, a naive observer, I think, could we consider a one-state solution because they're already so, both sides are already so interwoven. Does that make any sense?
I've gone back and forth on it. I have friends working on the ground on a confederated state idea, which is one state, two states. My instinct is a little closer in that direction, where I think that, for example, if the 500,000 settlers out of 2 million Palestinians, you know, they could stay, they could stay, but they have to be citizens of Palestine. They have to obey Palestinian police. And conversely, a lot of the citizens of Jerusalem can choose either way. I think there are ways for people to be members of more than one state at the same time, have dual citizenship, and then a collaboration of police, which was already going on.
Mm-hmm.
The most important thing that make people have the most unusual solutions is safety and security. Mm-hmm. When people feel safe and secure, when they feel that there are courts that they can go to for redress, and that's why the military courts of the occupation of Palestine have to end. If there were civilian courts run by Palestinians on the other side of the Green Line, if it was dual citizenship, I get the sense that there would be a great deal of economic growth and cooperation, and particularly the lack of a need for Hamas, the lack of a need for extremism. Extremism is there to say we're the only ones that can really protect you. But when you eliminate that need for protection, then people become more moderate. It doesn't mean that they're not more religiously fundamentalist, but religiously fundamentalist does not require a military outlet.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually a lot of very fundamentalist people in the United States who abide by national law, and they're good citizens, and they're just very conservative, and that's fine. It's the same in Israel and Palestine, because they know that when people know the police represent them, that's when society coheres. If they start to sense they don't, and that's why we had a lot of trouble with police, but the more the police have become integrated racially and representing, you know, all sorts of groups, the more that we ended up cohering as a country. And in many ways, as messy as it looks, there is the potential for that in this thing called Israel-Palestine.
Yeah. I would be remiss if I didn't say we still have some work to do on that here, but I hear what you're saying. Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, this is a rare opportunity to speak with you, and I don't want to squander it. In the few minutes that we have left, actually, maybe about 6 minutes, the one thing I wanted to ask you, it's a little bit selfish, is if you were to recommend a media diet for people who wanted to be well-informed on the public and not trapped by one story or a simplistic story, is there any kind of practical rule of thumb guidance you could provide for people who want to follow the conflict?
Well, I could give people a list of Twitter accounts that are more trustworthy. In general, there are seasoned diplomats who worked on this their whole life, and their perspective is usually more balanced. There's Martin Indyk, who was a 30-year veteran. There's Dan Kurtzer, Daniel Kurtzer. Aaron Miller. When you're in doubt, you go to the sites of people who just steer you towards interesting, balanced research and articles. Mm-hmm. And then there's people on a personal level who you stay away from what looks like an artificial site, and you try to go to people's real stories.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the other thing. But realize that, you know, when people are in a bad fight, like any town or family, and they're screaming, they're usually screaming to convince you that they're right and tell you only a portion of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So it really takes a lot to find those voices in media and in online that will give you a much more subtle. I urge people to read at least 3 or 4 books by Tom Segev.
Could you spell that last name?
His name is S-E-G-E-V. And he wrote so many books on the Palestinian narrative and the Jewish narrative. I recommend one, Palestine Complete. And there are a series of others. I do think NPR, when they do stories, are very balanced. Yeah, it's hard for me on standing on one foot to give all the best. Yeah, I think Al Arabi, if you're on the Arabic side of this, Al Arabi, it comes out of Qatar, but it's meant to counterbalance the more extremist kinds of things from Al Jazeera. So it's ARABY. I actually am on that television a lot. Al Arabi TV. That's going to be obviously more anti-Israel, but it's going to also give a little bit more of a balanced story. There's a paper called Haaretz, the land in Israel, that is a it's a lot of moderate voices. There's something called 972, which is a website that has more balanced stories. But honestly, there's good journalists everywhere, and you just have to find them like a needle in a haystack.
That helps.
Reporting you that most journalism is about bad news.
Right.
Something they can't help. It's the whole industry attracts people with bad news. What we're looking for is real stories, but also good news, because it's there. And you don't want, so that means organizations. You want to look up Tag Meir and see what Jews are doing together with Arabs. You know, there's Omdim Biyachad, standing together. It's an organization that brings Jews and Arabs together for education. There's whole schools in Israel that are designed for co-education between Arabs and Jews. And it's the Yad B'Yad, hand-in-hand schools. You find their website and you find what they're putting out on Facebook. It gives you a more complete picture, especially for educators.
This is invaluable.
Sorry, a lot of information, but I...
No, it's fantastic. And, you know, this program will be archived so people can rewind and listen to this several times and write down the names. So that all works. In just the couple of minutes that we have left, I just wanted to
follow me on Facebook, by the way.
Oh, please follow Mark Gopin on Facebook, GOPIN, Mark Gopin.
I'm on Twitter.
His website, he's on Twitter. Go to his website, markgopin.com, markgopin.com, and all the links are there. So, Mark, and look for his books also on Amazon or wherever. So, Mark, just maybe in closing, where your thinking is these days, what are you, besides this obvious conflict, what are your preoccupations or interests?
My preoccupations are the book that I just wrote. I really do believe that most things come down to how we transform our minds and hearts. Yeah. And that means how we listen and how we think about the future. So I'm trying to move the mind away from the pain of suffering and towards a compassionate joy in other people's lives, and thinking about how that applies to families, to communities, and whole countries.
Wonderful. I'm very excited to read that book and to learn more. Thank you, Mark Gopin, Professor of Conflict Analysis and Resolution at George Mason University. This has been an enormously informative and enriching conversation. Thank you so much.
A pleasure.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard Saturday mornings at 10:30 here on WGTD. Archive programs are available on our website at WGTD.org.
I'm Gregory Berg, and on Monday's morning show here on WGTD, we're going to remember a great singer, actor, and human being, Bill Hayes, who passed away on January 12th. His career included a stint on Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows, an appearance in the first Broadway cast of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Me and Juliet, and a long tenure on the soap opera Days of Our Lives. We talk about that and more on Monday's morning show, beginning just after 8.
Well, this weekend, WGTD's Noon Tunes, we're featuring the 6-piece jazz funk band from Kenosha, the Cal Bergendahl Project. At the end of every WGTD midday newscast, we feature a song by a local artist. So please join us for Noon Tunes Monday through Friday, 12:20 p.m. here on WGTD HD.